May it please the court, I'm John Minster. I represent Sandra Ferguson and the law firm of Sandra Ferguson. She's with me in court, sitting at counsel table. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The summary judgment order that was entered by the Superior Court should be reversed for the following 3 reasons. First of all, the Steve Teller fee agreement that was drafted by Mr. Teller is legally invalid, and I'll discuss the reasons for that. Secondly, there are a series of disputed facts which are material to whether a contract was formed between Ms. Ferguson and Mr. Teller, and if a contract was formed, what the terms of that contract were. And I'll cover those facts. Finally, if you find that the Teller draft fee agreement is not valid or that the judgment should be reversed due to genuine issues of material fact, then we ask you to enforce the fee agreement that Ms. Ferguson had with her clients that was fully executed by all four of them prior to the events that led to this lawsuit. The record is clear and perhaps undisputed that she engaged in substantial performance in that matter. So I'll first turn to the legal arguments that undermine the Teller fee agreement. First of all, there has to be consideration, since this was a non-proportional division of fees, or purported to be. Teller stated to Ms. Ferguson in an email that he would carry the bulk of the litigation costs, but the record is very clear that the crucial and only reason, that Ms. Ferguson brought Steve Teller into the case was so that he could pay approximately $100,000 in costs for 3 experts, which were necessary, necessary, to show the disparate impact, prove the disparate impact side of the case against the underlying defendant.
Well, he did, in fact, pay costs, did he not?
The record is clear that he wasn't being brought in so that he could
pay.
Well,
whether, not why he was brought in, but he did pay costs, did he not?
Well, he did not pay costs. I agree, he says in his affidavit that he paid $9,000 in costs. He does say that in his affidavit. However, those were not the costs which were the subject of the discussion.
Well, those weren't the costs that your client thought might have to be paid in order to resolve the case to the satisfaction of the clients. Seems the unilateral mistake is hers, because the case was resolved to the satisfaction of the clients without those costs being incurred, mm-hmm. and without the clients ultimately having to pay them. The problem in the presentation in your briefing mm-hmm. is it appears that your client's position is, unless her clients ultimately paid $100,000 more than her clients had to pay to litigate this, she was somehow cheated. But Mr. Teller found a way for the clients to reach a result that made them happy without them being ultimately responsible for the payment of that $100,000. I can't understand what rule we would promote here mm-hmm. that would require the clients to incur greater debt in order to settle their case just because there was a unilateral expectation on the part of one of the co-counsel.
I understand exactly what you're saying, but you're looking at it from the back end. In other words, what happened afterwards? And in this appeal, we're talking about whether or not the Teller fee agreement, which has a 50-50 split, which concededly doesn't reflect the work performed, constituted a contract that can be enforced against my client who never signed it. I agree with your observations as to all the positive effects of settlement, and in the civil world, we all want settlement. We want to avoid costs. But we're talking about, in this appeal, what it's about is what happened going in. And he did not agree, nor does the Teller fee agreement provide, that he had agreed to pay those costs, the $100,000 for the experts. He says, here's the redraft fee agreement. It has the 50-50 split, and also we discussed this.
Aren't you asking us to read in an unstated contingency condition that, even though it's not stated, provided that if you don't have to advance the $100,000, then the 50-50 deal is off? And that's nowhere in the documents or emails or anywhere else, right?
I'm not asking for an unstated contingency, but what I am asking is that that fee agreement not be enforced against Ms. Ferguson because it's lacking in consideration. The essential element of Teller's participation in this case, the reason he was brought in, and the only reason that he was brought in, was his agreement to pay for those experts. He didn't do that. That's why legally, as a matter of law, the Teller, what I'm referring to as the Teller fee agreement, is not a valid contract. So I'm not asking, again, for you to look at the back end. I agree 100% with what you said, Judge Dwyer, but we're looking at this at the front end. In other words, is this 50-50 split where she did, for years, all the work? Basically, Teller takes it on a silver platter.
Well, it's not just that Teller took it on a silver platter. As between the two of them, he was the only person authorized to practice law at the time that the case came to a head and was settled to the satisfaction of the clients, because your client had been suspended from practice. So he assumed the full burden and discharged it to the satisfaction of the clients.
Well,
I'm searching for a problem here other than your client didn't make as much money as she thought she would have, or as much money as she might have made had she not been suspended from the practice of law.
The problem is that he got into that situation without entering into a valid agreement with her because there was lacking consideration. Since this is a non-proportional fee split, it had to be in writing. There had to be joint representation. And as you've just pointed out, she was suspended from practice for a period of time, during which time she could not represent her clients. And it was during that time, and that time only, that Teller engaged in the settlement negotiations and reached the settlement, and which was done without my client's participation or involvement.
Mr. Munster, do you want to go into your rebuttal time?
I would like to do that. I want to finish up the thought.
Well, then, to your last point, then, if she had attempted to participate, wouldn't she be practicing law?
Oh, I'm not saying that. But,
okay.
But I'm saying one of...
You're not alleging that he cut her out wrongfully because he should have consulted with her at a time when she wasn't enabled by Supreme Court order to act as an attorney.
I'm not saying that she should have practiced law, but my point is that while she was suspended, he did the settlement such as in which he framed the settlement so that my client's clients were forbidden from talking to her. They had what I'll refer to as an order that prohibited them from communicating with her about the settlement after she came off suspension. That's the opposite of joint responsibility that you need for a non-proportional fee agreement. That's the opposite of it. And that's the point that I wanted to make about the suspension. And it's critical that it be looked at in that way. And I feel strongly that if you do, you will see that this Teller fee agreement, which, again, she never signed, should not be enforced against her. I'll take the remaining time. We've briefed the issue of disputed facts. There are a total of six of them in the court's order. Maybe I'll get to that on remand. Thank you.
Your Honor, it's Kelby Fletcher on behalf of Teller and Associates. We're asking this court to affirm the summary judgment, reverse the court's decision below with regard to sanctions, alternatively for this court to award sanctions. This court cannot review the assignments of error made by the Ferguson firm because the Ferguson firm has not perfected the appeal to include the opposition to Teller's CR-12C motion, the opposition to Teller's CR-56 motion, and the Ferguson firm's motion for reconsideration. You don't have before you any of the arguments or claims or defenses made by the Ferguson firm in the trial court below. The claim that the first fee agreement somehow is in play, that was never made before the trial court below. You don't know that, however, based on the record before you. I can only tell you that that claim was never made. Simply put, this court is without a record to allow you to review the appeal made by the Ferguson firm. In any event, a contract was formed. The objectively verifiable evidence in emails and documents produced by the two parties demonstrate beyond a doubt that they knew that they had an agreement to divide fees evenly and for Teller to assume the costs. It's undisputed that Teller paid all costs after his appearance. A notice of appearance was filed in November of 2011. He paid all those costs. There's no legal requirement, there's no evidence that he was unable or unwilling to assume payment of further costs if the case had not settled. There's absolutely a dearth of any evidence or any assertion.
Does that include the $100,000 in potential experts?
We don't know where this $100,000 comes from. There's no record of it below.
But it would include expert fees.
If he had to pay expert fees, that was his obligation. But the case settled. It became a moot point. This issue about bulk of the fees is a canard. He paid the costs, 100% of them. There's no dispute about that. The lien that was filed by the Ferguson firm specifically references the 40% contingent fee agreement.
I've made an assumption, and I think it was borne out in counsel's answers to my questions, but the basis for the assumption is that the clients always remain ultimately responsible for the payment of costs.
Correct.
In Washington. There's no contention here that there was any deal between these lawyers that would have provided for anything other than that, right?
Correct.
Okay.
But Mr. Teller advanced those costs.
No, I understand. Talking about these lawyers negotiating this agreement that I may have just assumed that the proper state of affairs was necessarily the state of affairs and thought I just better clarify it.
The clients are ultimately responsible for costs up to the point that the client is unable to pay them, and it's at the lawyer's discretion, therefore, to discharge that debt. However, there's no discussion in email or any obligation to assume a particular type of cost. Again, I think this is a unilateral mistake and a post hoc attempt to avoid the contract and frivolous in nature, given the back and forth between Teller and Ferguson and between Teller, Ferguson, and their respective clients. The contingent fee agreement that was propounded to the clients by the Ferguson firm clearly states there's going to be equal responsibility for the case and an equal division of the fee.
So the consideration was payment of the cost?
Consideration was payment for the costs.
Assuming responsibility for the case?
Assuming joint responsibility for the case, a case which had great difficulties already in the trial court before Teller got into the case. Multiple discovery orders against the Ferguson firm and against the plaintiffs. A trial date of July 2011. Ferguson was suspended from the practice of law in February of 2011.
For 90,
no discovery.
90 days?
For 90 days. The fee was ultimately paid after she was readmitted to practice. And by the way, there's no evidence that either Teller or the clients would object to Ferguson's reappearance into the case following the cessation of her suspension. No evidence to that.
What about the provision in the settlement that the clients were precluded from talking to Ferguson?
And that settlement agreement specifically states, so long as she is not your lawyer, you shall not divulge to people, including Ms. Ferguson, the contents, fact of, or amount of settlement.
So that was during the pendency of the suspension then?
Correct. If she reappeared in the case, she would have been entitled to whatever an attorney is entitled to know about his or her client. No attempt made to reappear into the case.
Presumably, there was enough information conveyed that people were able to discern the amount of money that was in dispute.
Correct.
By calculating whether the fee paid was, I mean, it was a percentage fee. It was a contingent
Correct.
Fee. So obviously, people had to know the on what the contingency was based, what percentage, in order to find out what they're even arguing about.
And the underlying defendant paid that into the registry of the King County Superior Court in July of 2011.
I've got a question for you that may require you to put your thinking cap on for a second. And it has to do, as you're aware, we've got two cases here today that stem from the same litigation. You're not involved in the next case. But the next case has to do with whether or not there was in a proper attorney's lien in existence. There is now money still in the registry of the court that's never left the registry of the court from when it was paid in, right?
That's correct.
Okay. If the attorney's lien is determined to have been proper in the next case that we're going to hear, is it true that it would always have and would continue to apply to that money that's in the registry of the court today?
I don't believe it would, Your Honor, because the money that's been deposited into the registry of the King County Superior Court in the underlying case was specified for attorney's fees as between the Teller firm and the Ferguson firm and did not involve counsel for any party. It was a segregated sum. And
but what I'm saying is if that argument doesn't prevail in the next case, in other words, if in the next case that money is determined to be proceeds, is there anything about this agreement that the parties in this case made that could apply to the detriment of the appellant in the next case?
I don't believe there's anything in the contingent fee agreement which applies one way or the other to any claim for fees in the next case.
Okay.
Now, they may disagree. I've not taken that.
No, I'm not trying to take up all your time on this either. It's another way of saying you might want to stick around.
I intend to.
Okay.
Teller performed under the agreement. He assumed a risk, the risk of loss, the risk of the case going south. He reviewed thousands of pages of documents. All of that is undisputed. What Ferguson firm wanted was a trial. And that wasn't what the clients ultimately wanted. Finally, on our cross appeal, I think you've seen from the record created in this court, five opening briefs filed by the Ferguson firm.
Can I ask you a question
about
the cross appeal related to the imposition of CR 11 sanctions? You're asking us to, I think, remand to the trial court to reconsider the ruling on denying the motion for CR 11 sanctions based on new admissions, new evidence. Is that fair?
That's partially fair. Alternatively, I'm asking this court to do it, and in my reply brief, our reply brief on the cross appeal, we cite both RAP authority and case authority for the proposition that this court can make that determination without a remand.
Okay. But if we decline that invitation, you're suggesting we would remand.
Correct.
Would you be able to, absent that request, would you be able to bring to the trial court independently the new evidence for purposes of moving to reconsider the sanction ruling?
I don't believe that would be possible, given the fact that this court would ultimately issue a mandate of some form. And unless there were some instructions of the trial court as to what it was to do and how it was to do it, I think the trial court would be without instruction. I think CR 59 and CR 60 by then would have expired. And so our only opportunity here is either for this court to make that determination
or,
ab initio
or, remand.
Or to remand.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In rebuttal to the Teller argument, I'm not going to respond to most of them as I feel that they fall into the argumentum ad hominem category. Judge Dwyer, with regard to your question about the money in the registry, with your permission, what I'd like to do is
we can talk about that.
Talk about that in the next.
Yeah.
Talk about that in the next round. The the confidential settlement agreement, the what I would refer to as the silencing order, is at CP 358. And as the record indicates, and as the briefing indicates, the fair construction of that, our fair analysis of it, is that the clients were forbidden from talking to Ms. Ferguson about the settlement and its contents with her, whether she was on or off suspension. So I would invite the court's attention to that, which is, it's attached as, it's CP 358, but it's also attached as an exhibit in the pleadings. Counsel says Teller performed, and we respectfully disagree with him. It is true that he asserts that he paid $9,000 in costs, but as the record and the correspondence and the affidavits indicate, the key factor was the payment, the agreement, consideration, the agreement to pay for the three experts on disparate impact. Teller says, well, we got some discovery from the underlying defendant. That discovery, it's my understanding, was produced in response to the discovery demands that Ms. Ferguson had served on the underlying defendant, and apparently it happened that while she was on suspension, these documents came in. So this isn't something that he did. I'd also point out, and I think it's indicated in Ms. Ferguson's declaration, that the settlement, the final settlement, occurred in late April of 2011, and the, I believe the record is undisputed that Ms. Ferguson, after she was suspended, went on a vacation, left her file for Mr. Teller to pick up in February. He didn't pick it up, and finally she brought it over to him. And he first had the file, according to the record, in late March of 2011, approximately 30 days, give or take, before this settlement took place. So the claim that he was working on the case, et cetera, that's made, we respectfully disagree with that.
Thank you, Mr. Munson.
Thank you very much.
The next case is...